wherever you are, come on up. We'll talk about lead sources and chemistry in the urban environment.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for inviting me here to kick off this symposium on lead in soils. My job is to provide a just general overview, and I was assuming that your knowledge of lead might be minimal. If it's not, just bear with me. I'm going to focus on three things. First, I'm going to run through a list of lead sources. And then second, I'm going to use some examples from my research to illustrate geochemical forms and some general things about lead chemistry. And then third, I'm going to draw your attention to some impacts of possible impacts of microartifacts. There's six basic sources of lead. Most rocks contain lead. Got to get my seeing glasses out here. Most rocks contain at least some lead, so lead is released by chemical weathering and accumulates in the soil. And this is what we measure as the natural background level, which determines whether or not the soil is contaminated. Anthropogenic sources include human additions of agricultural amendments, airborne deposition of lead-bearing particulate matter, waste materials from various urban and industrial sources that can be dumped on the soil or incorporated in the soil as a result of building construction or demolition. And we know that certain mine-related waste can be contain lead. They might not have the highest levels, but certainly the most geographically widespread would be mine spoils produced by strip mining of coal. The average concentration of lead in the Earth's crust is about 15 parts per million. So most soils have a background level between about 10 and 20 parts per million. Some rocks are naturally higher in lead, like some certain felsic granitoid rocks, some argillaceous sedimentary rocks, so the background level in those soils could be higher than 20 parts per million. We also know that coal has can contain iron-bearing or lead-bearing impurities, possibly lead that's actually bound as part of the bituminous material. That would also include carbonaceous shale associated with the coal, deep marine black shales like the Devonian black shales. Lead-206 is the ultimate byproduct of the decay of radioactive uranium, so at least some of that lead's probably coming from uranium. Some agricultural amendments have lead, some don't. I think it depends on what the material is that they're using to produce it. On the other hand, sewage sludge, I think, is pretty much universally high in lead and other heavy metals. There's been a lot of studies of that. There's places where they've applied sewage sludge to fields for many decades, and we know that you can find lead levels there of 100 parts per million or more easily. Atmospheric deposition, probably largely a legacy of the era of burning leaded gasoline. Also, the era of domestic coal burning, and it is ongoing as a result of coal burning too, right? Also, street dust or contaminated urban soil that's been resuspended by aeolian activities. Here's two sandy soils in Detroit, and the one on the left here, you can see the natural A horizon is brown. This is a soil heavily impacted by fly ash. This was right next to the Michigan Central train station, which had coal-fired steam locomotives operating out of there for many decades. And you can see how black the A horizon is. Not uncommon in Detroit to see a soil like this. mainly associated with car companies, but I didn't just say that. excuse me. Certain artifacts can have lead. In Detroit, our demolition site soils typically have somewhere in the range of 10 to 30% artifacts by volume. Although there are places I've seen that can have 90-95% artifacts, especially industrial sites. You can see that soil on the left. That was some pretty hard digging there. We actually hired a homeless guy and paid him $20 to help us dig that pit. Industrial waste, possible sources would be various types of smelting operations, steel making, manufactured gas operations, coal coking, railroad related waste, especially from the era of coal burning, shooting ranges, battery recycling plants. This is a soil that in Detroit that was located very close to a major railroad yard, and you can see they disposed of the coal cinders by relocating it in the neighborhood. During the course of strip mining, coal and carbonaceous shale becomes incorporated into the mine spoil inadvertently, and so mine spoil generally can contain lead. Also, coal refuse. Coal refuse is material that's produced by what we call coal washing, where it's a process of separating the coal from the waste rock. And as that material is typically, at least in Virginia, was taken up and dumped up in the head of the holler, the local nearby holler, and left in a big pile, like you can see there in the lower left. I don't know what happened to my cursor. Acid mine drainage can affect soil as well as water, and then you could have miscellaneous lead-bearing dust particles. So you can see there's a wide variety of sources of lead in the urban environment, and probably which ones you're going to encounter are going to depend on former land use, has been our experience. Traditionally, the geochemical forms have been determined using some sort of sequential extraction procedure. We know that this is not the best way for measuring bioavailability because the results are generally semi-quantitative at best because there's some problems. For example, the extracting solutions aren't exactly as selective as we'd like them to be. And also there's problems with resorption by phases that are in the sample. I had an idea many years ago of adding a chelating agent to our extracting solutions to counteract resorption, and I had a couple graduate students work on that. And make a long story short is we now routinely add about 400 parts per million of NTA, nitrilotriacetic acid, to our extracting reagents. Before we did that, the levels of water-soluble and exchangeable lead that we got were generally below detection limit. Now we're actually getting measurable amounts, which I think are more realistic. This is really an important problem because suppose you're in step two, you knock the lead off the exchange site, you've got manganese oxide still in the sample, resorbs your lead, then you're grossly underestimating the amount of bioavailable lead that's in the sample. Carbonate occluded fraction is probably targeting lead that's either part of the crystal structure of calcite or is specifically adsorbed on the surface of the calcite. We know manganese oxides have a tremendous specific adsorption affinity for lead. Not particularly common in rocks. Some mafic rocks can be pretty high in manganese oxides. But we know it can be anthropogenically enriched as a result of particulate matter derived from steelmaking. We've documented that in Detroit. Organically bound, this is not exchangeable lead. This is lead that's tightly bound or covalently bonded or somehow tightly bound with soil organic matter. And then we know iron oxides also have, especially poorly crystalline iron oxides, have a very strong specific adsorption affinity for lead too. The residual fraction, that is lead that's lattice bound within silicate minerals. We measure that with a hydrofluoric acid digestion. Certainly not bioavailable. So just to give you some idea of the kinds of things that we've seen in Detroit, I selected a couple of demolition site soils from a suite of about 14 or 15 that we've analyzed in detail. And one of the things we commonly see is that if the soil is not calcareous, the lead tends to be either mainly in the organically bound or oxide occluded forms. If the soil is calcareous, and we're in alfasol country in Detroit, so the soils tend to be highly calcareous, we get a significant amount, in some cases a large amount, in the carbonate occluded fraction. We did some sorption isotherm analysis, and we determined that the sorption capacity of our soils in Detroit, the calcareous ones, 150,000 parts per million lead. Another thing we commonly see is that there is a correlation between total or sum total lead and the labile or bioavailable or bioaccessible lead, which would be I'm including water soluble and exchangeable as labile. Another thing we did was we looked at roadside soils along an urban-rural transect. Site one was in downtown Detroit, and then we collected roadside soils at 30-kilometer intervals extending out into the country. And, of course, we saw the levels of lead drop off as we left the city dramatically. We generally don't see lead levels much higher than about 300-350 parts per million, something like that, although we're analyzing 0 to 6 inches. I think if you looked at maybe the upper couple centimeters, it'd be quite a bit higher than that. Another thing that we noticed is that as you get in toward the city, you start to see higher and higher levels of the residual fraction. And this was, I was mystified by this for many years, but I think I finally figured out that it's being caused by micro artifacts. So over the years, there's a lot of discussion about lead in various phases, lead-bearing phases, which are really difficult or impossible to identify by X-ray diffraction. We think they're there, but we don't really know that they're there. So I was curious as to where these things would come out in the course of a sequential extraction analysis. So we used some reference material, reference minerals from our collection. And so we used cerussite, anglesite, pyromorphite, and ran it through sequential extraction. And the lead carbonate, cerussite, came out mainly in the carbonate occluded fraction, which was good, kind of what we expected or was hoping for. Most of the lead sulfate, the anglesite, also came out in the carbonate occluded fraction, although maybe a third of it also came out in the organically bound fraction. And then the lead phosphate, we use pyromorphite. Most of it, it's very insoluble except under very strongly acid conditions, so it didn't come out until the very most acidic extracting solutions that we were using. And then we ran it through the ruby-type bioaccessibility glycine extraction that we used, I think it was pH 2.5. And surprisingly, we got almost no lead came out of the pyromorphite. Very little came out of the lead sulfate, and about half of it came out of the lead carbonate, which would be, you know, equivalent to paint. So quite a bit of that was bioaccessible, which we expected. Another thing that I was curious about is how bioaccessible various fractions that we determined in sequential extraction would be. So we selected some reference minerals here to simulate the different phases we were targeting in sequential extraction, and we included apatite, calcium phosphate, along with that. We spiked these with 400 parts per million lead, and then we ran them through the glycine bioaccessibility extraction. And the results are really interesting. Pyrolusite, the manganese oxide, sorbed almost all of the lead, but wouldn't give any of it up. Likewise, peat sorbed almost all of the lead and didn't give up hardly any of it. Apatite didn't sorb a lot, but it sorbed quite a bit, more than I thought that it would, and gave up about half of it. So this suggests that the lead is being maybe either precipitated on the surface of the apatite or being specifically absorbed by apatite, which I wasn't expecting that. It's not actually precipitating as a separate phosphate phase. And then calcite, we got about 50% of it sorbed almost all of it and got about 50%. So this was interesting because this suggests that what is bioaccessible or bioavailable in the sequential extraction procedure is water-soluble, exchangeable, and maybe half the carbonate occluded fraction. The rest of it isn't bioavailable. We've done a lot of work with artifacts and micro-artifacts, and one of the things we were interested in seeing is whether micro-artifacts were common in urban soils, and this shows some of the micro-artifacts we found in residential demolition site soils, quite a few. Typically, by the way, an artifact is defined as artificial particles greater than 2 millimeters, right? Soil taxonomy doesn't define micro-artifacts. Micro-artifacts were defined by archaeologists as 0.25 to 2 millimeters, which is medium to coarse sand. And we found that the artifacts are really, micro-artifacts are really pretty common in urban soils in Detroit, maybe 10 to 30% typically by volume, but could be as much as 70, 80, 90%, especially in an industrial site soil. One of the things we did, we were curious as to whether we could identify these, so we took artifacts that we knew what they were, crushed them up, got out the sand fraction, and sure enough, we were able to identify them using the kind of mineral identification techniques we use in reflected light microscopy. So we were curious, you know, as to how much lead some of these things might have. So we collected an assemblage of different artifacts, a couple different kinds of brick, mortar. This is actually mortar from demolition of 19th century buildings, concrete, iron slag, coal combustion products, cinder block, terracotta, which is used for sewer pipes back in the day. And we analyzed them for lead, arsenic, mercury, and zinc using a portable X-ray fluorescence unit. And coal ash stands out as having the highest levels of all those metals. The iron slag was surprisingly really high in mercury and also zinc. Zinc's not particularly toxic, but it's kind of taken as being an indicator of anthropogenic influence. And then if you look at the average of all these, it's really interesting because you can see these artifacts on average, well, in the case of lead, these are the background levels down here for Detroit soils. The average lead content of these artifacts is 3 times the background level. So it's something to keep in mind if you're using X-ray fluorescence. Another thing that we found quite a bit in Detroit soils is artifacts that were weathering were actually producing materials like ferruginous materials or calcareous materials that were actually kind of ameliorating or immobilizing agents for lead. So having artifacts is not necessarily a bad thing. By the way, this is a thin section of a weathered nail. You can see the ferrite core. The orange is very hydrite, the brown is goethite. And so weathering of ferruginous artifacts, calcareous artifacts, may actually be beneficial in urban soils. So artifacts, not just a source, but also a sink, at least certain ones. So anyways, just to kind of summarize, from our experience in Detroit, the most widespread sources are urban waste generated by fossil fuel combustion and building demolition, waste building materials. Geochemical forms vary as a function of human activity, really correlating with former land use history. Sequential extraction we found is very useful for identifying the geochemical forms, if nothing else, at least in a qualitative way, and they should be combined certainly with other techniques to assess the bioaccessibility. Things I didn't really get to talk about too much, like sorption isotherms and bioaccessibility tests. And then hopefully I drew your attention to the fact that artifacts and micro-artifacts are both a source and a sink for lead and maybe other heavy metals. By the way, I have a new book out called Anthropogenic Soils, which Springer does not have down in the main room down there. But you could get a copy from the Springer website if you're interested. I think the ebook is like maybe $75. It's a real deal.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.